Yeah, well, in this episode, I'm just trying to ask the impossible question, right? So, which will make this an impossible episode. Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world.
Like what, like if somebody says the word culture to you, what does that make you think of?
I would say beliefs.
Traditions.
Heritage. That's the word I was looking for. Heritage or heritage. Okay.
Beliefs.
Yeah.
Art. That's culture.
Ooh, culture. Let's see. I should know because I was an anthro major in college. The norms and customs and beliefs.
Yay. What about you guys?
What is that for?
Aiden, what does the word culture mean to you?
I have no idea.
I like an honest answer. This was a trick question, really, because there's no easy answer to what this word culture means. Raymond Williams, the British academic who helped shape the field of cultural studies, called culture one of the two or three most difficult words in the English language. Incidentally, the word he calls the most complex is nature. But sometimes it's worth asking an impossible question. We're going to give it a go. For help, I reached out to two academics, Michael Zeiser, Associate Professor of English at UC Davis, and Caleb Scoville, a graduate student in sociology at UC Berkeley. Both of them, like me, are interested in the relationship between culture and nature. In fact, they've both essentially taught the academic version of my podcast, so, as you can imagine, I wanted to talk to them. As we go through bits of our conversation, I will pause to explain as I think is needed. Some of this is heady stuff. Let's start at the beginning. Culture comes from a Latin word, cultura, that derives from another Latin word, colere. It's from colere that culture gets its earliest meaning, essentially cultivation or the care of land or animals. Michael Zeiser has an interesting story about how he came to reckon with the origin of the word culture.
To go back to where my fascination with this sort of all began, you know, I had gone through an undergraduate career at UC Berkeley in English literature and Latin literature and Russian literature. And then when I graduated, I took a little time off. I got a extremely well-paid job as a construction worker in Utah for a summer plus the fall. And I was just out in the dirt all the time, out digging things up. And I think my mind was running on, what is the connection between all of the literary things that I had just stuffed my brain with for four glorious years as an undergraduate and, you know, this wider physical material world that was out there? And I think, you know, there were some markers at that time. There were some eco-critical work out there that I was able to find and to follow up on. But I think that really the first solid epiphany I had was about this word colere, colo, colere, cultus, from which we get the word cultura and culture, and that it was basically about, not about how human beings interacted with each other, especially not through written forms or printed forms that wouldn't come about for a couple thousand years or more, but it was about how people passed along the practices that they use in relationship to the non-human world. That could be plants, it could be animals, it could be landscapes or other kind of physical features. And once I thought about that, I was like, well, yeah, agriculture and culture, you know, it's more than just a kind of trivial pun. It actually goes pretty deep into our understanding of what humans are and what they're doing. And I know, you know, now I know, of course, that like if you are an anthropologist or you're somebody who's sort of focused on humanity before civilization, let's say, this is totally unsurprising and not, you know, and no epiphany at all. But for somebody who was really focused on, you know, the modern world, let's say after the invention of the printing press, it did seem like something that had been lost and that we ought to think about some more.
So, the origin of this word and what it tells us about where we came from, how we cobbled together culture out of this contact with the earth, bodes looking into. I talked to Zeiser about the fact that this origin of culture in the cultivation of the land is like a two-sided coin. On the one hand, it evokes our connection to the earth and our dependence on it for food. On the other hand, it speaks to the ways in which humans have damaged the earth. Think about the plow. I was recently visiting my mom in California, and I was woken up one morning by the sound of a plow digging up a field to plant lemon trees. It was loud, and not exactly subtle. Nowadays, soil scientists argue that plows deplete the land of its life and its richness, tearing up the complex microbiome of the soil and harming its structure.
There are a fair number of kind of eco-critics, and I find myself agreeing with them, even though it's sort of utopian, I suppose, or totally impractical, that, you know, humanity made an enormous ecological mistake by wedding itself to agriculture, to sedentary agriculture. And I still kind of think that on an ethical level. So one of the things I had to kind of overcome when I was working on my first project was to recognize how powerful an instrument of knowing the world something like agriculture or other kinds of environmental practices are, and also not to mistake that for like the morally righteous thing to do or the ecologically appropriate thing to do. There is just an enormous amount of destruction that has happened as a result of it. And sometimes as kind of a sideline or as an incidental part of it, it's produced a lot of knowledge about the world. So this, you know, destruction that we've inflicted on the natural world is really closely related to the knowledge that we have of it. And that's it's a painful thing. We like to have our knowledge like from ethically uncompromised sources, but I think that that's an impossible task really for somebody who's interested in ecology.
So going back to colere, so then how does the word evolve? So it moves, in my understanding, it moves from a cultivation of the earth to a cultivation of the mind, kind of by metaphor.
So when I was doing it, my kind of touchstones were, I'm an Americanist and I study early American literature. So I was thinking about the context that they would be thinking about this word in. And by the time you get to the 19th century in particular, but even in the 18th century, people would talk about culture as self-culture, as governing the interactions between human beings, but also the way that one reflects on one's own behavior and starts to come to philosophical kind of understanding of oneself. So it's getting fairly abstracted, and that's actually, you know, part of the story is that that culture is moving away. It's no longer obvious. You know, that's why it could come as a shock to me, and you know, the year 1997 or whatever, that agriculture and culture were really closely related. The other thing was that those people were heavily influenced by Roman agricultural writers who also were involved, you know, as at the center of a large civilization and empire, interested in disconnecting and abstracting and kind of refining out the cultural values that they had from the agricultural background that they were in.
This gets to a part of our conversation I found fascinating. I knew that the connection between humans and the natural world was embedded in the word culture and its connection to agriculture, but what I didn't know or hadn't really thought about was the ways in which culture as an idea, but also as a practice, emerged out of agriculture too. Zeiser talked about his work on Georgic poetry, a genre of poetry that starts with Virgil and that takes agriculture as its theme.
So the Georgic form, it goes back to Virgil and his Georgics, and it goes back into the Greek past as well. But it's a poem that it's based on, it's usually in four parts, subject matter, the cultivation of the earth or the pursuit of a particular kind of agriculture. So one book might be about row crops and farming from the ground, and another might be about collecting honey or raising bees. Another might be about wine making. That was a big one back in the classical era. And so it was the occasion for all sorts of reflections on society and politics, and was studied as such for quite a while. But it also, you know, just had to come to terms with the kind of intransigence of the material world, all the elements of it that don't lend themselves quite so easily to being taken up into human symbology. And so if you read them with a kind of eye for that, you sort of see the non-human world kind of poking through this otherwise very civilized kind of cultural production.
This poking through of the natural world is the focus of much of Zeiser's research, another example of the ways in which culture is cut through with nature. But getting back to the word culture, I mentioned earlier that the meaning evolves from the cultivation of the earth to the cultivation of the mind. Caleb Scoville and I discussed this when we were talking about Raymond Williams' entry on culture in his book Keywords. Keywords is one of those books I keep returning to. Its subtitle is A Vocabulary of Culture and Society. It's organized like a dictionary and offers a history of the uses and meanings of the words he highlights. As I mentioned to Scoville, when culture is used to mean cultivation, it is essentially something you do, an action, not a thing.
Yeah, I think he says something, it's a noun of a process, a tending of something. I think we still have this idea. It's in the very word agriculture and aquaculture, viticulture. So I think it sets up, as you suggested, a tension or a relation between nature and culture. It's, you know, we might say, I mean, this is not exactly what he says, but there's wild nature that's uncultivated, and then there's something that we do as humans to intervene or to shape nature. And that is this idea of cultivation.
Scoville pointed out the class implications that come into play when you start talking about people as cultivated or uncultivated.
Because he was very interested in questions of class. So I think in the idea of cultivation, he also sees, and this is maybe this is more particular to the British context in which he was writing, but and of the time, and his sort of social position. But this idea of cultivation, I think he says at some point takes on a very sort of classed notion. It becomes correlated with class in the sense that certain individuals are understood to be cultivated or not cultivated, right? So it becomes, there's an analogy between, I mean, you mentioned the plow, which is the literal, you know, plowing the earth and cultivating the soil and crops. But then people also become understood as being cultivated. And there's a sense in which education or upbringing takes on an analogical relation to raising crops.
One thing that I thought was interesting too, and this is something he highlights, is that it goes from being a word of process, whether it's the cultivation of the soil or the cultivation of the mind, to a noun. Culture either with a capital C or culture, you know.
You know, one of the questions is, What are the sort of contrasts that the definition sets up,
right?
So if you're talking about process and you're talking about cultivation, right, the distinction is between the cultivated and the uncultivated, right? So maybe you have wild nature that's uncultivated, or the soil, as you mentioned, that's unplowed, or you have a person who is not of certain cultivated status or something like that, right? If you're talking about culture as a noun, there are two kinds of contrasts that can be set up. One is that which is cultural and that which is not cultural, right? So you have culture and its others. Mm-hmm. Or you have culture A and culture B, as in different cultures.
Right.
Right. So these are, you know, these are related but actually distinct uses of the term culture. One says basically there are certain domains, perhaps in social life, that are cultural, and there are certain domains that are not. So people might oppose culture to the economic. They might oppose culture to the natural in that case. But then there's also the idea that there are certain cultures that are in some sense bounded.
Why does this matter, you might be wondering at this point? Well, Raymond Williams thought that the word culture and other of these key words, nature, as I mentioned, is a big one, are like keys to unlocking the history of how we came to be the way we are, how we came to think about who we are and what our values are. Think of it as the code to the matrix. To make sense of it all, it helps to pay attention to the very structure of these words and the way that they're used. For example, the fact that culture evolves quite literally out of our relationship with the natural world, and yet culture is often defined by contrast with nature, in other words, as that which is not natural. Makes your head spin, I know. To help us a bit, Scoville and I used an article that's on his syllabus for a class he teaches on culture by the political scientist and historian William Sewell. It's called Concepts of Culture. Sewell begins his article by going through different meanings of the word. He gives us some sort of handy definitions to work with. So if you don't mind, can we just sort of go through them sort of bullet point and tease them out a little bit? So the first one he gives us, which he dismisses kind of rapidly, is culture as learned behavior. And I think he's referencing Levi-Strauss in particular. That's where the sort of culture-nature division really comes in, right? Sort of trying to, you know, in Levi-Strauss, he talks about, for instance, these sort of legendary cases of children who were brought up in the wild, the sort of wolf boy or something like that, and trying to figure out what is culture. So does that seem like a useful way of summing up that particular version culture?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, and I think that, I mean, Sewell's a bit dismissive of this idea, but I think there are contemporary sociologists who are interested in broad sort of patterns of human behavior across societies. So if you're interested in a comparative perspective, maybe you have a interest in national comparison, looking simply at how behavior, learned behavior, is different in different places, that might be fine. And that actually might be a very helpful sense in which culture operates.
Well, and Sewell talks about how this definition of culture was also used against racial arguments to show that the difference between social groups was not based on a kind of racial or quote-unquote natural distinction, but was really cultural, which I thought was an interesting piece of sort of the history of anthropology.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally right. So, I mean, if there are differences that are natural, that might justify some kind of natural hierarchy, right? Or natural differentiation. And I think in a lot of ways, to say that these are cultural differences, they're cultivated differences that do not rest on kind of biological substrate alone, then in some ways that's a very progressive position to take against kind of, you know, scientific racism. Of course, the cultural distinctions can also be used to kind of justify a sort of hierarchy among cultures or among peoples, right, by saying that certain ones are more advanced than others. So it doesn't necessarily get one out of that problem, but at least it makes it rest on something that's not quote unquote natural.
No, and of course, that's one of the ways in which culture can be a loaded term too, right? When people associate culture with what we might call high culture, you know, to be cultured or not cultured. And that speaks to the second definition he gives us, which is associating culture with institutions. So institutions of art, music, theater, religion, education, so on. And he's a little bit dismissive of that as well. How do you see, is that a definition of culture that you think is still, well, it's certainly in play in a kind of, in a loose sort of common sense. Is it something that comes into play in sociology too?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of two minds on this. So I think, you know, analytically, I have a problem with it, but it is worthwhile to take, say, like art and literature, for example, as a domain of study and to call that something other than, say, politics or economics. You're doing something legitimate in the sense that you are highlighting an important domain of social life that deserves to be studied and maybe deserves to be studied on its own terms.
Of course, the way that we use terms like art and literature goes back to mostly to the early 19th century and specifically the attempt to kind of distinguish those aspects of social and human life from money, from politics, and all those things. It was in some ways a different climate than what we're in now, but one has to remember that what the sort of original motivations were, which is, you know, wanting to be able to write something and not have it be co-opted by some kind of economic or political agenda.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I think that's fair. And I think, you know, a lot of people who would say design a sociology of culture course would focus on, you know, art and media and perhaps religion, although religion is often relegated to a separate field for good reason. So that, I think, is fair. But I think, you know, analytically, I have a little more trouble with it because it sort of implies that all other domains of life are not cultural.
Right.
Right. And I think this is probably the problem that Sewell has with it, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I think so.
You know, it sort of makes a lot of presuppositions about first what culture is that are probably not defensible, but also maybe even where culture comes from, if we agreed on a conception of culture that's around meaning. And just at least from my perspective, you know, I see culture in just about all domains of social life, including things that are very much material and very much economic and very much political. And in fact, I don't think we can understand, say, contemporary politics without kind of cultural analysis. So I think when you try to really define culture out of those domains or spheres, I think it becomes a lot more difficult than just saying, okay, well, these are sort of areas of social life that deserve to be studied in their own right.
Well, the other thing that Sewell says, which is interesting, is that if this definition of culture is intended in some way to separate out art and literature and so on, that ironically, it ends up sort of giving them less heft. I think he uses the word froth at one point, because so much social capital is in economics and political life. So then sort of culture seems like something sort of extra or peripheral. It's like a luxury, basically, I think is one way of putting it. So I'm going to jump ahead. So the next definition he gives us is culture as creativity or agency. So in this sense, he says that refers to the way particularly Marxist and American sociologists use it, and it's sort of to see culture as in opposition to economic structures and social structures, which I guess would be more deterministic. And so in that sense, culture is something that gives some kind of agency to people who are otherwise don't have as much agency.
It makes sense, because a lot of the sort of really kind of basic Marxist view would be that, okay, there's an economic structure, or there's a mode of production, there's a set of economic relations, and that is sort of the base, and then everything else is sort of, you know, built on top of that is superstructural, right? And so ideology, culture would be kind of just like synonymous with ideology. All the ideas we have are essentially outgrowths of, but have no sort of causal or sort of agentic import beyond, you know, where they sort of come from in the brute reality of economic and material relations. Now, that may not be fair to Marx and Engels, but that's sort of one interpretation that's been given. So an attempt to kind of square the circle and to allow more room for dynamic change, you know, for change and for agency and transformation, has been to sort of give human agency the name culture, and to try to integrate more cultural explanations into a generally Marxist framework.
Okay, you may not have been bargaining on Marxist analysis. I get that. But bear with us. Here's a quick recap. Number one, culture as learned behavior. Think the nature versus nurture debate about children. Number two, culture as institutions. Think the opera and what my husband likes to call culture vultures. That expression always gives me the willies, but what can you do? Number three, culture as human expression or creativity that isn't determined by economic or political pressures. Think art for art's sake. Now, brace yourself, because we're about to take a little dive into linguistics. Okay. All right, moving on. So number four, we have culture as a system of symbols and meanings. And there he's basically speaking to...
Let me interject here. Can one interrupt oneself? Yes, I think one can. In short, this symbols and meanings business is the inheritance of a Swiss linguist, Ferdinand de Saussure, and a bunch of French philosophers in the 60s and 70s who took on his theory of language and really ran with it. This led, among other things, to the idea that you could read, say, a car commercial in a way not that dissimilar to how you might pick apart a poem in a literature class. In other words, language becomes a model for thinking about the production of meaning more broadly, beyond language in the strict sense.
This associating of culture with essentially language is the word that I would use, is an important part, because you were talking before about how you don't feel like culture should just be limited to, you know, the kinds of things that you might find in a culture column, you know, or I guess it's not a column these days, but like in a culture article, or, you know, the culture editor, say things like that. So, you know, we think of, obviously, like we've talked about literature and the arts, but also television, popular culture. But you think that culture is something, a word that can relate to basically all aspects of human social life. And so the question is, I guess, what do we mean by that then? Like, how do we explain that? And one way to explain that has to do with the way that we make meaning out of things, to simplify a little bit, right? And so one model for how we make meaning has been language, but then language has sort of been extrapolated to a system of symbols, or there are different ways of understanding it that play out in all aspects of social life. Does that seem like a fair way of
saying it? Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think a lot of it comes from like Saussurean linguistics, and just the idea of like language as a system of signs, right? And so, you know, understanding how different sort of terms or sounds or inscriptions or gestures become signifiers for different kinds of meaning, and then how they relate in a system. I think that is a way that culture has been understood in sociology, and often is invoked that way still. And that allows you to see culture not as like a specific domain relegated to a certain column or to a certain section of the newspaper or to certain types of activity, but as a kind of dimension or net. I think Sewell often uses the term net, that kind of casts over all of society. So not every single thing that we do is necessarily cultural, but there's a cultural dimension to every kind of domain of social life. And that dimension has to do, as you said, with meaning, with systems of meaning, and how meaning is generated and invoked in life as we act as social actors.
So all of this is very human-centric. And of course, we think of culture as being fundamentally human. But remember, culture at its origin is about that contact with the natural world. Towards the end of my conversation with Michael Zeiser, we loop back to this beginning. In the bio on the UC Davis website, I confess that the part that intrigued me the most was the last line, which reads, "His current household animal census includes 2 kids, 2 dogs, 2 fish, 4 chickens, 50 silk moths, and approximately 100,000 honeybees. Now, I'm going to have to ask about the silk moths, but before we get to the silk moths, I was thinking about the honeybees. I assume this means that you keep bees for honey. And if so, I was wondering if honeys give you bees give you a particular view on culture.
Yeah, interesting. Right. So right now, I went on sabbatical a few years ago, and I couldn't keep my bees. That's not the kind of thing you can ask your renters like deal with for you. So I gave myself to a budding apiculturist at Davis, and I still right now I'm probably not in the immediate future will go back to it. But when I do, there's another. I was keeping bees in the conventional way, in the boxes that you may see if you drive along orchards that need to be pollinated or what have you. But there's another way of keeping bees with African style hives that's a little bit less, it makes the bees less susceptible to disease, which is of course a big problem. Anyway, that was, I learned a lot from my long experience exposure to bees. But in terms of what I learned about culture, the big thing was, one of the things that really I pursued quite a bit was the idea of this question about honeybee language, and whether or not they were actually, you know, how should we understand the communication system that they are employing when they are going out and finding new food sources or new hive places to put their colony. Does that count as a language? Is it an index? Is it an icon? What kind of semiotically? What is it? And by thinking through that, that Carl von Frisch, you know, the famous German bee scientist, is the one who detailed a lot of the elements of the various bee dances and communications. And there's been a lot of research since, you know, qualifying or extending his work. But, you know, it really made me think about language quite differently. And it made me think about the fact that, because one of the, you know, I guess one of the durable boundaries between the human and the non-human is that we humans communicate through language as we're doing now. And, you know, in as a humanist, even a more specialized form of language, kind of academic written language. And you know, even though here and there are some species that seem to be able to communicate in a way that's analogous to ours, for the most part, the natural world, you know, doesn't engage in this channel of communication. But a lot of the work in animal cognition and animal communication shows that they have a zillion other ways of communicating, and that actually they're no less complex or philosophically significant because they don't employ the larynx and the tongue and the teeth and lips, right? But they come through some other channel. And once I thought about that, then I thought, okay, now I can see that there are at least the building blocks of culture, quote unquote culture, even among non-human beings. And then, you know, those can either be isolated through scientific means, through by experiment, or there are certain places where the symbology or the communication system of an animal or a plant overlaps with our own human systems of communication. And there we have this, I don't know if it's really communication, but it's sort of like a productive miscommunication where we are engaging with a non-human species. And if that happens, then the whole question of where culture ends, where the boundary is, whether it is just a human venue, is, I think, blown open. And suddenly the natural world is not something, it's really no longer an object that you just study, but it is a communication, it's a communicating system that you are already involved in some way. And that, yeah, to me was a really kind of mind-blowing recognition. And it's one, you know, in your day-to-day life, it's hard to keep it at the forefront of your mind and not go completely insane. But it is really, I think, at the root of a lot of things, the way that I approach some of these questions as they come up in environmental ethics or environmental humanities.
That's interesting. I wonder, thinking about the bees, I wonder if one thinks of language less in terms of symbols and more in terms of use, kind of more in a Wittgensteinian way, if you don't inevitably conclude that lots of animals are very efficient in terms of language, right? I mean, certainly we can see whether this, we understand exactly how bees communicate or not, we do know that they're able to tell each other in some way that there are good food sources over here, right? And things like that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot less chit chat. Yeah,
less BS
for sure.
Getting things done,
and you know these kind of ways of undermining our own sense of species specialism, you know, I think are really valuable. Edgar Allan Poe kind of famously said, you know, he has this little weird essay called "Instinct versus Reason." And he talks about animal instincts, and he says that actually they're just the most highly refined, you know, evolved, he didn't have the word evolved, but the most highly refined kind of reason, and that our, you know, human reason is just kind of bumbling, you know, an undercooked kind of not really quite aware of what it is that its goals are, right? And I always love that, number one, for kind of acknowledging the impressive cognitive feats of various non-humans, but also reminding us that human beings are, you know, that a lot of what we call like the most refined elements of our civilization are sort of just like this record of bumbling, or, you know, of being off topic or whatever, as a species. And And that's fine. We can celebrate that. But we, you know, the kind of speciesism that we naturally fall into doesn't survive that revelation.
Yeah. I have two kids in my household as well. And I have to say there are times as a parent that I marvel at the survival of our species.
Really? I know. You mean really? Somebody had to hover over them to make sure they didn't fall down the well?
I know. No way. Yeah. No way. Did this happen, right? If you've made it this far, you get some sort of prize. I'm not sure what it is yet. Maybe a guide to those African beehives Zizer was telling us about. We'll have to look into that. And I'm sorry we didn't get to the silk moths. Another time. Thanks for listening. Coming up, we've got wolves, an episode on making olive oil, one on Genesis, the B word, all kinds of exciting stuff. We'll be back soon. Remember to tell a friend to subscribe to the In the Weeds podcast. Bye now. All right. Here's my question. What does the word culture make you think of? All right, Justin, come on. Okay. You've got something. What does the word culture make you think of?
Makes me think of, like, groups. People. Like, yeah. Sure, Justin.